This episode features discussion of terrorism, religious extremism, and mass murder that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13. The House of Culture in Dubrovka was abuzz. The year was 2002, and the audience was returning to their seats for the second act of Nordost, the biggest play of the season.
The lights went up on the stage to reveal an ensemble of dancing pilot cadets. The audience cheered as the show resumed. The crowd was captivated by the spectacle on the stage.
They were so enthralled that they didn't notice the men in ski masks lining the aisles on both sides of the audience.
The audience wasn't alarmed at first when one of these men walked on stage brandishing an assault rifle. Nordost was a military-themed production, so maybe this was all part of the show. But then...
he fired his weapon over the crowd. The actors on stage froze as the realization hit the citizens in the auditorium. The gun was real, and they were now all hostages.
Welcome to Hostage on the Parcast Network. Every week, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them. We'll examine hostage negotiation tactics and what the human brain does when held captive. I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy. You can listen to all of Parcast's podcasts on your favorite podcast directory. New episodes come out every Thursday. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you listen.
This is our first episode on the Moscow Theater hostage crisis.
On October 23rd, 2002, a band of 40 heavily armed Chechen rebels invaded the House of Culture in the Dubrovka area of Moscow during a performance of the hit play Nordost. Approximately 900 audience members and show crew were taken hostage. The terrorist goal was to use the hostages as leverage to force Russian President Vladimir Putin to withdraw forces from Chechnya.
This week, we'll take a look at political forces that ultimately led terrorist leader Movsar Barayev to lead the attack on the House of Culture. We'll also introduce a handful of the innocent hostages who lived through this horrific event.
Next time, in part two, we'll dive into the hostage situation itself and the series of events that led to all 40 terrorists being killed, along with over 200 of their hostages.
First, let's talk about the leader of the Chechen rebels, Movsar Barayev. We know Movsar was born around 1979 in the Chechen Republic. He was raised Muslim and grew up in a torn and embattled country surrounded by extremists.
Movsar's native Chechnya is a small country located in the southernmost part of Eastern Europe. While officially a federal subject of Russia, a significant number of Chechen citizens reject Russian rule. Because of this, the country has both a regional government, officially recognized by the Russian state, and a separatist leadership, which is classified as a rebel organization. The two countries have been in conflict for most of Chechnya's recorded history.
The resentment between the Chechen people and Russia runs deep. In what has now been classified as an act of genocide, Russian leader Joseph Stalin deported the entire Chechen population in 1944. As part of a broader political scheme, nearly 500,000 Chechens were booted from their homeland and forced to work at the labor camps in Central Asia. Reports vary as to how many perished, but some state that it was more than 150,000.
Nikita Khrushchev later allowed the Chechens to return to their country in 1956, but this horrible human rights violation was not forgotten.
Movsar Barayev grew up hating Russia. The hatred ran in his family. Barayev's uncle was the infamous Chechen warlord Arbi Barayev, and by most accounts, the two were close.
In September 1991, when Movsar was around 12, extremist members of the All-National Congress of the Chechen People stormed the local government building in their capital city of Grozny and declared independence from Russia.
3 years later, in 1994, Russian forces invaded independent Chechnya and incited the First Chechen War.
Many Chechens took up arms and joined the resistance. Though it's unknown when this practice began, Russian authorities treated Chechen boys 12 and older as adults, the age when they're able to pick up an assault rifle. This meant that even though they were adolescents, they could still be shot as an enemy combatant.
It was during this conflict, under the instruction of his uncle, that Movsar Baraev began to learn about hostage-taking as an effective tactic.
RB Baraev had eagerly joined the Chechen separatist side and fought against Russian soldiers, eventually becoming a field commander in the Chechen army. RB's name became synonymous with hostage taker, as during the war he frequently captured and ransomed Russian civilians in order to pay his soldiers.
RB Baraev wasn't the only one who thought hostage taking was an effective military strategy. One of the most notorious figures to rise during the First Chechen War was a man named Shamil Basayev, who would come to be another influential figure in Movsar Baraev's life.
Chechen forces utilized a strategy of guerrilla warfare in its conflict against Russia. Shamil Basayev was one of Chechnya's most effective guerrilla fighters.
In 1995, 7 years before Movsar Baraev's attack on the theater in Dubrovka, a convoy commanded by Basayev crossed the border into the Russian city of Budenovsk, 70 miles north of the independent Chechen Republic of Ichkeri.
The convoy contained 80 to 200 Chechen separatists.
As the most recognizable of the group, Shamil rode in the back of one of the vehicles. A few hours into their excursion, the convoy came to an abrupt halt.
They had hit a police checkpoint. Unable to provide the proper paperwork, the soldiers were rerouted to the local police headquarters in the city center.
When they reached the Budenovsk police station in the city square, Shamil signaled his soldiers to attack. They burst from their trucks and opened fire on the police.
Their attack was decisive, and soon they were occupying the police headquarters in the Budenovsk City Hall. A green flag with three stripes along the bottom, two white, one red, was raised over both these buildings, the flag of independent Chechnya.
However, this flag wouldn't fly for long. Russian forces were on the advance.
Shamil Basayev and his soldiers watched the Russian forces rally from the captured buildings.
Shamil Basayev's forces quickly abandoned the police station and moved to the local hospital, which they quickly took over.
Basayev and his men now had control of a hospital building with well over 1,000 hostages. Hours after the initial capture, a man emerged from the building, hands held over his head. He was one of the doctors, and he had been released to relay Shamil Basayev's demands.
They were simple: an end to the war on Chechnya, withdrawal of all Russian troops, and reparations for the decades of harm Russia had done to their country. These demands would be repeated often during Chechen hostage-taking missions, including the 2002 siege of the House of Culture.
In this case, Russian President Boris Yeltsin refused to negotiate. Parliament was considering filing articles of impeachment against him, and he could not afford to look weak. 3 days later, Russian special forces, Spetsnaz and FSB troops, stormed the hospital.
The soldiers found themselves face to face with armed, desperate terrorists who were using the hospital personnel as human shields. That didn't stop the Russians, and a deadly firefight ensued.
When the smoke cleared, over 100 hostages were dead, and the Chechen terrorists still had control of the hospital.
Brute force wasn't going to win this battle. In the weeks following the failed assault, Russian officials attempted to deny giving the order to attack, but the damage was done. Russia had failed its people. This marked the beginning of the end of Boris Yeltsin's presidential career and a turning point in the eyes of the Russian people. They no longer trusted the government with their lives.
Russian Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin attempted to persuade the Chechens to release the hostages, a negotiation which took place over national television and only embarrassed the government further when it failed. Eventually, Chernomyrdin backed down and agreed to a ceasefire and peace talks.
In spite of the horror and chaos they had witnessed, some of the rescued hostages insisted that they had not been mistreated by their captors. To them, the Chechens were freedom fighters rather than terrorists.
In their 1978 report on hostage survival, experts J.R. Reber, L.W. Singer, and F.M. Watson contend that the key to survival as a hostage is quick adjustment to their new lives as hostages. The doctors and patients at the hospital, many used to a caretaker role, started to empathize with the desperation in the Chechen fighters during the length of their captivity.
When the hostages were released, some even bade tearful farewells to their former captors.
The surviving insurgents, Shamil Basayev included, were granted safe passage back to Chechnya. They were even granted a refrigerated truck to transport their dead with them.
To the Chechen soldiers, the success of this 1995 operation proved the validity of the taking of mass hostages as a military operation to accomplish political goals.
However, Movsar Barayev would have to wait before he could oversee such an operation on his own.
In 1996, the Russian government, under Boris Yeltsin, brokered a peace treaty, which allowed Chechnya to maintain its independence for the time being. Many people credited Shamil Basayev's forces and their actions in the hospital with ending the war. Chief among them was Movsar Barayev.
Coming next, we'll cover the Second Chechen War and how Movsar Barayev rose to power.
Now, back to the story.
The period following Chechnya's independence from Russia was far from peaceful. As was the case in many war-torn nations, Chechnya was saturated with organized crime.
Like many Chechen military commanders, Arbi Barayev had to find new ways to continue his life of combat. He felt compelled to continue his war against the oppression of Russia. To that end, he founded a combat unit which he commanded for the rest of his life. This was SPUR, the Special Purpose Islamic Regiment.
A primarily Muslim country, Chechnya proved to be fertile ground for religious fundamentalism to take root. Many Chechen insurgents, including Movsar Barayev, identified as warriors of Islam.
In his book, The True Believer, Thoughts on the Nature of Mass Movements, Eric Hoffer provided an explanation for why religious extremist is so appealing to people in desperate climates.
Hoffer claims that the type of person most likely to become part of a fundamentalist movement is a person, quote, who, for one reason or another, feels that their lives are spoiled or wasted, end quote. The Islamic fundamentalism in Chechnya appealed to this existential desire for meaning, as well as the generations of resentment toward their oppressors in Russia.
In the 2003 book, Terror and Liberalism, Paul Berman described the common factors between contemporary Islamic terror movements and historically oppressive regimes. Among these are a longing for a pastoral, idyllic past and a tendency to blame some exterior or interior force for the evils of the present. And Russia gave the long-suffering Chechnya the perfect exterior force to blame.
With everything Russia had done to Chechnya, it's unsurprising that a number of Chechens turned to religious fanaticism in an effort to save their country. Their anger against the Russian government turned into righteous fury against the people of the country itself.
In the mid to late 90s, Arbi Barayev's spur was linked to a series of high-profile crimes, including the murder of several Red Cross employees and the kidnapping of journalists and aid workers. Barayev was not restricting himself to Russian targets anymore.
In the years immediately following the First Chechen War, Movsar Barayev's uncle Arbi had some difficulty with the Chechen government.
The relatively moderate Chechen president, Aslan Maskhadov, knew that he had ceded a lot of political control to men like Arbi Barayev, who commanded splinter factions of soldiers and functioned essentially as warlords.
In 1997, Maskhadov attempted to placate these men by giving them government positions. He appointed Shamil Basayev as his vice prime minister and put Arbi Barayev under the command of the Chechen Interior Ministry.
Ever the rebel, Barayev refused the appointment. So Maskhadov forced multiple members of the SPUR to publicly confess to kidnappings on television. Enraged, Barayev went rogue, taking hostages and even going so far as to engage Chechen government forces in a large-scale gun battle alongside some Islamist allies. It's unknown if Movsar Barayev was involved in these campaigns, but given how close he reportedly was to his uncle, it's certainly a possibility.
Between 50 and 80 people were killed during Arbi Barayev's mutiny, and he was subsequently stripped of his military rank and declared an enemy of the Chechen people. From this point onward, SPUR's relationship with the Chechen government became a dubious one at best and violent at worst.
Meanwhile, Shamil Basayev resigned his post as vice prime minister and also returned to his life as a combat commander. In 1998, Shamil and his ally, Ibn al-Khattab, invaded the adjacent Russian Republic of Dagestan in an attempt to establish an Islamic caliphate.
This coincided with bombings in the Russian cities of Moscow, Volgodonsk, and Ryazan that following September. The state-controlled media and politicians in Russia pinned the blame for these bombings on Chechen terrorists. Most notable among the outspoken Russian leadership was 46-year-old future Russian President Vladimir Putin, who was then head of the Federal Security Service. He took a strong stance on crushing Chechen resistance.
But rumors persisted that the Chechens were not behind the bombings, and the Russian Federal Security Service, or FSB, had in fact organized these attacks. As it turns out, FSB agents were caught planting secondary explosive devices in the city of Ryazan. Russian humanitarian Sergei Kovalov noted, quote, "We don't know who carried out the bombings of the apartments. We do know who used it. It was the campaign staff of Vladimir Putin," end quote.
Chechen President Maskhadov subsequently declared a gazavat, or holy war, on the Russian army in retaliation for the perceived attempt to frame Chechnya for a terrorist attack. The moderate who had won the election was no more. President Maskhadov found himself fighting alongside Shamil Basayev and Ibn al-Khattab.
The human rights violations committed by both Russians and Chechens against each other throughout the 1990s has had some academics questioning the use of the term terrorism to describe anti-Russian Chechen attacks. Olga Nadskakula, a professor of political science in Krakow, once stated that the conflict between Russia and Chechnya was simply irreconcilable. According to her research, Russian leaders are intent on keeping Chechnya from having independence using any methods necessary. And Chechens, in turn, have adopted the motto, quote, "death or freedom."
Unlike the First Chechen War, the second conflict went largely unreported in Russian media. Chechnya was so dangerous that few journalists dared venture there for a story, and the state-controlled Russian media was intent on stoking anti-Chechen sentiments among the public.
The Russian media did tie Chechen guerrilla fighters to Osama bin Laden. Ibn al-Khattab claimed to have met bin Laden and undergone training in Afghanistan alongside members of al-Qaeda. and some of the Arab militants who trained Khattab were spotted in a home video of Mavsar Barayev training in the woods. For many, this is a strong indication that Mavsar and his comrades were supported in some capacity by al-Qaeda.
While they employed similar strategies, any actual collaboration between Chechen insurgents and al-Qaeda seems to be sporadic. The relationship seems to have been more based on bartering for supplies than collaborating on battle strategies. The ties between Islamic terrorists in the Middle East and the Islamic fanatics in Chechnya is not inconceivable, but many believe that Putin's government exaggerated their ties to win support from the West.
There was one common tactic used by the Chechens and al-Qaeda: suicide bombings.
In June 2000, 16-year-old Luiza Magomedova and 17-year-old Kava Barayeva plotted the first recorded suicide bombing carried out by Chechen terrorists.
Kava was Arbi Barayev's sister and Mavsar Barayev's aunt.
Luiza and Kava drove a truck filled with explosives into a Russian special forces barracks just south of Grozny.
According to a spokesman for the Chechen rebels, Kava Barayeva's last words were, quote, "I'm going willingly to my death in the name of Allah and the freedom of the Chechen people," end quote.
After breaching the perimeter, the women detonated the explosives, killing themselves and around 27 Russian soldiers.
This bombing had a monumental impact on the methodology of warfare between Chechens and Russians. Suddenly and tragically, bombings became a horrific norm.
Arbi Barayev was finally killed on June 22, 2001, in a raid by Russian special forces.
After his uncle's death, Mavsar, now in his early 20s, took command of the Spur.
Mavsar now had his own squad of loyal soldiers willing to die in the fight against Russian oppression. He had seen firsthand how the tactics of taking hostages and employing suicide bombers worked as effective terrorist strategies.
As Mavsar Barayev planned to take hostages, Russian artists planned a landmark theatrical production.
In the mid-1990s, Russian folk musician Georgi Vasilev was inspired. He had just witnessed a production of the acclaimed musical Les Miserables, and an idea was forming in his head. He had never seen a production of such scale in his home country and desired to bring Broadway spectacle back with him to Russia.
A savvy businessman as well as a musician, Vasilev had invested in the 1990s cell phone revolution in Central and Eastern Europe. His portfolio afforded him the assets required to fund a new play.
His first idea was to purchase the rights to Les Miserables, but eventually Vasilev and his songwriting partner, Alexei Ivashenko, decided to go a different direction. They realized that it would be a stronger statement to write a musical of their own rather than import one from the West.
The duo took a cue from Les Miserables and Phantom of the Opera and wrote a musical based on a popular piece of literature, in this case, the iconic Russian novel The Two Captains by Veniamin Kavarin.
A shamelessly melodramatic piece, the play was intended as an affirmation of Russian pride. Vasilev described it as a story that elevates us and our history. It's a story that enables us to look at our history not as the history of class struggle, wars, and repressions, but a history of people and personal achievements.
Vasilev and Ivashenko founded their own theater company and set about producing the play themselves, hiring actors, technicians, and production crew to make the show as big and unforgettable as anything on Broadway. According to some accounts, they developed the hardware and software for 6 separate computer systems to handle the elaborate special effects, lighting, and sound cues necessary for Nordost.
Perhaps one of the reasons this particular production was a target for Barayev's group was the escapist nature of the show. For the people of Chechnya, war and strife was constant, while in Russia, 1,000 citizens a night could sit down and watch a gaudy musical about the Cossack spirit without even thinking about the damage their military caused in their neighbor state. The musical was a tremendous hit with Russian audiences.
Its most ardent fans were teenagers and young adults. While not quite Broadway prices, the tickets were fairly expensive for Russian theater standards, the equivalent of about $15 to $30, exceeding the prices of Russia's famous Bolshoi Theater. By October 2002, Nordost had been running for over a year and had amassed a massive fan base.
The Broadway-style production extended to the show's extensive marketing campaign. The producers of Nordost plastered billboards all over Moscow in a way that few other Russian stage shows ever dared. Imagine if Times Square featured only advertisements for cats.
On the night of October 23rd, 2002, the audience was a mixture of Russian citizens and international visitors. One of these attendees on that fateful night was Veselin Nedkov, who would later write a book on the terrifying ordeal he was about to experience.
Nedkov bought tickets to the show as a gesture of gratitude to Irina Filipova, a Moscovite teacher who had been giving him English lessons in preparation for his move to Canada.
There were a number of children present that day, both in the audience and backstage.
Nordost featured a number of child performers, including Alexandra Rozovskaya, Kristina Kurbatova, and Arseny Korilenko, all of whom were 13 years old. As the technical crew bustled backstage to get ready for the start of the show, Alexandra's mother, Svetlana Sergienko, went backstage to help her daughter get into costume.
Only one of these three child actors left the theater alive.
Up next, we'll dive into October 23rd, 2002, the night of the Moscow theater hostage crisis.
Now back to the story.
To the first-time viewer of Nordost, the first thing that stood out as you entered the theater was the astonishing set design. The stage was not concealed by a traditional curtain. Instead, the theatrical space was concealed by a series of gray sliding panels dressed to resemble corrugated iron. These moving metal panels pulled back to reveal a stage which was comprised of six long ramps and an elevated walkway, all of which could be raised and lowered based on the needs of the scene.
The House of Culture was not a traditional Russian theater, which was exactly what had made it the perfect fit to house Nordost. The venue had been specifically chosen by the show's producer due to the extensive technical requirements of the show.
The crowd on Wednesday, October 23rd, wasn't sold out. The House of Culture had a seating capacity of 1,200. Still, the audience of nearly 1,000 was considered quite sizable for a weekday show. The press coverage and cultural focus on the show had all but made it a target to any potential extremist attacks.
Intermissions in Russia are generally longer than the ones in the United States, around half an hour. However, even with that extended time, one couldn't get through all of Nordost's lobby decor. On top of programs, merchandise, and refreshments, the theater lobby was lined with children's artwork depicting the story of the play, driving home just how much of a cultural movement this production was. In fact, there was so much memorabilia in the lobby that entering and exiting the theater was something of a hassle, a fact that would only make the ensuing crisis all the more difficult.
Intermission ended at around 9 p.m. The lights flashed, signaling the audience to go back to their seats. As the citizens were filtering back to their seats, anticipating the next act of the show, three vehicles were pulling up outside the theater entrance.
As the great metal curtains raised and the second act began, armed men unloaded from the vehicles and advanced on the building. According to eyewitnesses, the vehicles were left with their lights on and engines running. The Chechens clearly weren't planning on leaving the same way they came in.
Marina Krylova, the house manager, had just finished clearing the lobby after the last audience member returned to the auditorium. She was returning to her office to oversee the rest of the show when she heard a loud, crashing noise. Concerned that one of her staff had gotten into an accident, Marina headed back to the lobby to investigate.
When she reached the lobby, Marina found herself face to face with a group of masked men armed with pistols and assault rifles. The terrorists grabbed Marina and then proceeded to round up what theater staff they could find. According to Marina, she had an opportunity to flee, but she decided to give herself up willingly. She worried the audience wouldn't grasp the seriousness of the situation, and Marina wanted to do what she could to help. She stayed back with her staff as they were all forced at gunpoint into the auditorium.
Marina's instincts proved to be spot on. As many survivors of the incident recalled, not knowing at first, this act of terror wasn't part of the play. The initial bursts of gunfire fired by the terrorists were paltry in comparison to the sound levels of some of Nordost's other sound cues. Many audience members only came to realize that they were no longer watching a play when they saw the plaster falling from the ceiling, a sign of fresh bullet holes.
The actors, on the other hand, knew immediately there was cause for alarm, but their prop weapons were naturally no match for the real rifles the terrorists brought onto the stage. The company could only watch in horror as Movsar Barayev mounted the stage and announced his intentions in Russian. Quote, "We are from Chechnya. A war is going on there. We have just brought that war to Moscow." End quote.
The terrorists were all masked, except for Barayev. He sported a black cap, which allowed his face to be seen. This was his moment, and he wasn't planning on hiding who he was.
Show creator and producer Georgi Vasilev was checking with his crew in the control room when the first shots were fired. Nestled above the balcony, the control room, was one part of the building that the Chechens didn't capture in their initial raid on the building. From the safety of the control box, Vasilev watched in horror through security camera footage as his show and his guests were taken captive by armed extremists.
A few of the crew who had not yet been captured made a break for the exits. Vasilev, however, did not move. Though he knew he likely had enough time to get out before the terrorists locked down the building, he knew that he had a greater responsibility to the people who had already been taken hostage. Vasilev chose to enter the theater of his own free will and surrender himself to the terrorists. In his own words, the people in the audience were his guests, and he wasn't going to abandon them.
The terrorists were efficient, herding all of the people in the theater into the central auditorium in a short amount of time. They pulled the actors from backstage and forced them into the audience as well. Child actors Alexandra Rozovskaya, Kristina Kurbatova, and Arseniy Korolenko had been rehearsing backstage and had barely heard the initial shots.
On the stage, Barayev oversaw the implementation of the next step of his plan, suicide bomber-backed security. Several of the terrorists unloaded large canvas bags from the wings. These were filled explosive belts. The female members of the group, maybe 18 or 20 in all, each donned one of these suicide belts and primed them. Barayev introduced these explosive-clad women as widows, all of whom had lost loved ones to Russian violence.
Each woman had a pistol in one hand and a grenade in the other, with a safety ring around their finger. If any of them were attacked, they'd drop the grenade, which would set off every explosive in the theater. These individuals would later come to be known as the Chernaya Vidova, or Black Widows.
The Black Widows were following the example of Kava Barayeva and were ready to give their lives for a free Chechnya.
If the government didn't accept Barayeva's terms, or if Russian special forces attempted to rescue the hostages, the women would detonate their vests and kill everyone in the theater.
These Chechen women had all experienced incidents of heartbreak during the Russian occupation. Some of their relatives had vanished for weeks, only for opportunists to show up and sell the grieving family information on where they could find the corpse. Others had family members leave for work and never come back. This kind of loss isn't an uncommon motivation for terrorists. In 2011, a conference on violent extremism brought together almost 100 ex-neo-Nazis, jihadists, and other reformed extremists. As reported by The Economist, many of these individuals found a common ground in their upbringing, regardless of the ideology they turned to. Many had struggled with feelings of abandonment and loss.
After introducing the widows, Mavsar Baraev briefly conferred with a man known only as Abu Bakr. Then, Mavsar turned to the crowd and demanded that they relay his demands to the authorities with their cell phones. He added that they should call their loved ones and say their goodbyes.
The captors unfurled banners on the stage, black banners with Arabic letters on them.
By this point, the theater was thoroughly rigged with explosives. The largest of these was a gas tank stuffed with an artillery shell surrounded by nails, ball bearings, and metal fragments.
According to Russian bomb experts, this nail bomb was powerful enough to bring down the whole building. It was positioned near the front of the theater, guarded by one of the explosive-clad women.
Baraev addressed the crowd again in Chechen, most likely inquiring whether there were any Chechens in the audience. No one moved. Baraev continued. Now he asked in Russian if there were any Muslims in attendance.
Some people stepped forward and identified themselves as Muslims. Baraev announced that all Muslims were allowed to leave. However, according to the survivors, none of the Muslim hostages elected to leave. They stayed, remaining in solidarity with their fellow hostages.
The Chechens continued their work of transforming the theater into a deadly prison. The captors divided their crowd of hostages into Russian and non-Russian groups. A native Bulgarian, Veselin Nedkov, was placed among the non-Russian group. However, he did not want to leave his English tutor behind. He approached one of the terrorists, a clean-shaven Chechen named Yasir, who, to Nedkov, seemed to be the most approachable of the male Chechens.
On Nedkov's instruction, Arina Filipova claimed to be Nedkov's American wife who had lost her passport. The pair of them didn't want to be separated in the event the Chechens chose to release the group of non-Russians.
Yasir was dubious at first, but Arina attempted to reason with him in English. Not wanting to prolong the process, Yasir permitted her to join the non-Russian section of the crowd.
Nedkov and Arina made their way to the back of the theater with the rest. The noise in the auditorium had reached a low murmur. Some audience members were still on the phone with their families, and many were still sitting frozen in their seats.
When they were relocated to the back of the theater with the non-Russians, Nedkov turned to the nearest Chechen terrorist. She was older than the others and seemed to command some authority.
Nedkov asked this woman why they were doing this. Her terrifying, emotionless response was that the Chechens were all prepared to die. They wanted to die more than the Russian hostages wanted to live.
Over the next 2.5 days, the Chechen terrorists would see this wish fulfilled, and they would bring many of their innocent hostages with them. Next week on Hostage, we'll follow the negotiations between Mavsar Baraev and Vladimir Putin, the psychological toll it took on the captives in the theater, and how Russian special forces chose to break this dangerous stalemate.
You can listen to Hostage and all of Parcast's other podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, CastBox, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast directory. And if you enjoy the show, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you listen.
We'll be back next week.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted. Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Michael Langsner, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admeyer and Carly Madden. Hostage is written by Robert Teamstra and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.